So I should begin by saying that I'm here on slightly false pretenses, because although the title of my talk is Changes in Attitude Toward Women in Mexico from 1772 to 1885, that's a pretty big mouthful, and were I to address that, I'd have you in your seats for 30 hours instead of 30 minutes. So I'm going to instead focus on a particular aspect of attitude toward women in Mexico in this period, and those address the issue of attitudes toward virginity. It's highly appropriate that I should focus on the topic of virginity in the context of the Semaine de Mexique, which is an event celebrating the developments of the modern nation of Mexico. And it was inaugurated on Monday by Mexico's new ambassador to Canada, Señor Francisco Suarez Dávila. Because in point of historical fact, virginity and its associations have played a central role in the construction of ideas of the nation in Mexico throughout the time period that I'm covering here. Most historians would agree that the symbol of the Virgin of Guadalupe, which was first supported by the institutional church in Mexico, starting in the 17th century, but particularly promoted by them in the 18th century, then taken up by the insurgents in the revolutions of independence. So when I say colonial, some of you may not be as familiar with that. So colonial refers to the whole period from the conquest of Mexico by the Spanish in 1519. Until independence, which is in a 10-year period starting in 1810. So the Virgin of Guadalupe, that symbol, is taken up by the revolutionary forces of independence, and it's eventually embraced also by the new national government. So it's the symbol of virginity itself. The Virgin of Guadalupe is central to ideas about the nation. And this is an image from that's just representing one of the earliest celebrations of the symbol, especially of the Virgin of Guadalupe. This is from a publication from 1746 called the Escudo de Armas de México, the Coat of Arms of Mexico, published by Cayetana Javier de Cabrera y Quintero. And the work, as you can see, there's an image of this important national symbol, Guadalupe. And in this, the text itself described her protection of the city of Mexico in a terrible plague in the year 1736. And it was this publication, which 1746 is the year of the publication. It was the same year that Pope Benedict XIV kind of crowned Guadalupe as the patron of New Spain. New Spain is what people called Mexico in the colonial period. And so it's this work itself is seen as one of the earliest manifestations of what's called Creole patriotism. So it's too early to say nationalism because it's pre-independence, but it's the beginnings of the association of nationalism. Virginity, albeit within a very different set of connotations, continued to be a central focus in ideas about nationhood in the end of the period I'm talking about today, in 1885. And when I make this point, I'm specifically referring to a work by a physician and historian of Mexico called Francisco Flores, who published a tract called El Himen en México in 1885. And I found this work when I was gathering research materials for the monograph that I'm writing that Jessica mentioned, which is a history of childbirth and contraception in Mexico. This is the image I have here of El Himen en México, the original title page, and the work itself was recently re-released, and I was interested to see the painting that accompanied the re-release of the work, which is a contemporary painting to Flores' painting. This is a work by a prominent 19th century Mexican painter, Manuel Ocaranza, and the painting itself, El Amor del Colibri, the love of the hummingbird, but the central focus, actually, it's hard to see the hummingbird. Hummingbirds perched on the side of the white flower, but it's a young woman, you know, admiring the virginal white flower. And Ocaranza was fond of the topic, and he had done a sketch of the El Amor del Colibrí, and then also the companion piece, the sad La Flor Muerta, so sort of before and after shots illustrating this reverence for the white flower and then the lost, the dead flower. So the work itself, El Himen de México, by this historian and physician, he was a pharmacy professor at the Escuela de Medicina de México, and he contributed in it to the blossoming late 19th century field of hymenology. His text on the Mexican hymen, along with a host of materials dealing with public sanitation and health, policing and incarceration, was one of the contributions selected to represent Mexico in the World's Fair of 1889. So this work, which, you know, might surprise you to learn, was actually seen as something for Mexico to be proud of and advertise itself to the nation. So that the científicos, which are the political advisors of the president at the time, that they selected Flores' work for inclusion at the World's Fair, demonstrates the ongoing preoccupation that virginity held for Mexicans in this later period, in 1885. I have various points I want to make this afternoon about the issue of virginity and preoccupations with virginity in the time period that I'm covering, but I want to make explicit the central argument that I'm making about this changes. And that is that although we may associate Catholic-infused colonial Mexico, so the Mexico of the 17th century, the Mexico of the 18th century, as a time when we would expect expectations and anxieties and pressures for women concerning virginity to be at their peak, it's actually, I argue, in this later period, in the late 19th century, in the era of liberalism, that we see the enshrinement of the imperative of maintaining sexual purity amongst an expanding sector of the country's population. So it's the pressure increases, and most significantly, my main argument is that whereas earlier on the pressure was especially on elite women and concerns about policing sexual practices and reproduction was more aimed at elites, over time this becomes a pressure that hits a larger segment of the female population. So that's where I'm heading with this, but let me back up and talk about the colonial context a bit more, about how was virginity manifest, what were concerns about virginity in the colonial period. So as many of you are no doubt aware, Catholicism was the central ideological framework for colonial Mexican society from the mid-16th century, early 16th century conquest throughout the colonial period. Catholicism is kind of the dominant ideology, and specifically the image of the Virgin Mary was one that was the most widely reproduced image of womanhood for women of all classes and races in Mexico. And Mary herself was celebrated in sermons, was discussed in the catechism, was reproduced in colonial artwork, in paintings, in sculpture, on altar pieces, before which women prayed in public, in churches, or in their own homes. And such depictions, no doubt, inspired colonial women in various ways and were personally significant to them, including at the moment that they themselves became pregnant. And this is just an example of the extent to which the role of Mary was taken by women into their own lives. When I was tracing how women dealt with the idea of becoming pregnant and preparing for labor and delivery, I found that they would try to create blessed associations personally with Mary, seeking her protection throughout pregnancy, labor, and delivery in prayers, icons, and engravings. And when nearing or entering labor, some women consumed holy wafers upon which were inscribed a text known as the Words of the Virgin. And they were, I'm translating but quoting also, "In your conception, O Virgin Mary, you were immaculate. Pray for us to the Father, to whose Son you gave birth." Others carried these words inscribed in little sacks that they wore around their necks or fastened to the heads of their beds. So the fact that they did this is just one example of the way in which we see the iconography of the symbol of virginity that is taken very concretely into women's everyday practices. And we know that women of all classes were devoted to the image and example of Mary in colonial society. Yet it also has to be acknowledged that women in this society were able to reconcile their reverence for this example, this impossible example of a virgin mother, with their own sexual and social realities. And what I mean by this is that they were devout people who revered Mary's example, but who, out of choice or necessity, did not follow it. And this is suggested, among other things, by the fact of the astonishingly high rate of illegitimacy, which is reproduction outside of marriage, that characterized colonial Latin America, or colonial New Spain in particular, but actually all of Spanish America. So illegitimacy rates in Spanish America in the colonial period were about 4 times as high as European illegitimacy rates and as high, 4 times as high as Anglo-American society. So it's a particular trait of Latin America in the colonial period. In Mexico, illegitimacy rates ranged in the 17th century from 7 to 50%. There's quite a lot of geographical specificity and variety. In the 18th century, from 7 to 35%. And just to give you another concrete example, in one affluent Mexico City parish, over 1/4 of those born throughout the colonial period were illegitimate. So I don't mean to make this sound like some kind of argument that a Republican senatorial candidate from Missouri might make in, say, 2012, but I would venture to observe that for a substantial portion of the population, reverence for virginity occurred at a more abstract than actualized level. The story was a little different for members of elite society. Just as Mary's marvelous womb had been necessary for the production of Christ, virginal brides were essential to the functioning of colonial Mexican society in more prosaic terms. The arrangement of elite marriages in New Spain, which was had a thoroughly racialized social organization, required virginal brides. At the elite level, colonial society policed female sexuality and reproduction because claims to both blood purity, and that phrase some of you may not be familiar with, this kind of preoccupation in colonial and modern Latin America is with an idea of what's called limpieza de sangre, which translates to mean cleanliness of the blood. And it literally referred to the idea that you could trace that your family was free of association originally with either Jewish or Muslim blood. And in the New World, it quickly became translated to mean free of association with either African or indigenous blood. So to be to rise or remain in elite society, one had to have clean blood, sangre limpia. Because of that, and also the same thing applied to the issue of civil legitimacy, if you wanted to either rise or remain in the elite, you had to be a person born within wedlock to be a legitimate child. And because those two things could only be established through the mother physically, and paternity was never proven or could never be proven, obsessions about tracking clean blood and legitimacy all rested with the mother. So the preoccupation with policing virginity was particularly strong in elite sectors. Now, there are various kinds of sources from the colonial period that document this, these, you know, very pronounced issues about female sexuality, virginity, and race and class hierarchies in colonial society. And I'm going to describe a couple of different kinds of sources. The first ones come from 1772, the first bookmark of my talk, and they were what were called dispensations for impediments to marriage. These were applications that couples would make to the court of the archdiocese, the courts of the secular church, and they would make them in order to overcome impediments to marriage. Impediments to marriage had been set out in the 16th century by the Council of Trent, and they regulated the reasons why people couldn't marry. And one of those, a number of them, deal with incest. So there was blood incest, sanguine incest, and there's also affinal incest, incest by lot. You're not allowed to marry your deceased sister's wife. Something like that. So one of the things that's interesting when you're looking at taboos about marriage and how did people address this is to look at these applications to dispense with these impediments. And I looked at a whole body of them from the year 1772 in the Archdiocese of Mexico City, where I found that virtually every application was assented to. And what this meant was that when people were appealing to marry their cousins, that it's often a cousin, and sometimes it's an uncle appealing to marry his niece, the church accepted that. And the argument that they accepted was the argument that it was better to commit incest than to marry somebody outside of your racial group. And they literally make the phrase that's used is el cortidad de el lugar. So I translate it as the smallness of the place. And applicants would write this in their petitions, quote, the smallness of their town made it difficult for those of clean blood to marry equally. So it's less of a sin to marry your cousin than to have to, than the argument is, than to go outside of your racial group. So that's an illustration of the kind of, you know, racially and socially, the racial and social strictness of marriage couplings in the colonial period. We also see social preoccupations with preserving virginity in two other kinds of legal cases. One is in suits involving rape, and another is in suits involving what was called palabra de casamiento, which is literally the word of marriage. The casamiento suits occur when a couple, a man has given his word that he's going to marry a woman, and she in turn has engaged in sexual congress with him, kind of as a, you know, bargaining on the assurance that eventually they're going to be married, so her virtue will remain intact, and then he absconds. And in that case, usually the family of the woman launches a formal lawsuit saying, we had palabra de casamiento, we need this rectified. We can see the issue of the whole concern with lineage and race in these trials, in both palabra de casamiento and in rape trials, particularly if we look at the kind of justice that courts gave, the kinds of sentences that they passed. Usually that courts would restore what they saw as a violation of a code by either requiring the men in question, if they were found guilty, to pay fines to the woman's family, or, including in cases of rape, to marry the woman. And the rape of a virgin was always considered more heinous than the rape of a married woman because the crime carried a greater potential loss to the family's prospects, to the marital prospects of the family. Colonial period in these kinds of legal trials, in palabra de casamiento and rape cases, the magistrates often required physical examinations of the women involved in order to determine if rape or sexual intercourse had occurred. One of the things that I was interested to find when I was researching the idea of virginity in the colonial period was that medical literature that physicians relied on in the colonial period and jurists relied on were not unanimous in their notion about what the biological evidence revealed. So I consulted various medical texts that I know doctors were reading and that were sort of the canon of medicine in 18th century Mexico, and found that there was a lot of discrepancy, even on the particular question of the hymen and whether or not its presence or absence indicated whether a woman was a virgin. I'm not going to take you through, you know, a million medical texts. I'm going to give you one example. So it's an example of the writings of a French doctor called François Morisseau, and he wrote a tract called the Traité des maladies des femmes grosses, pregnant women. And in his text, he wrote, and this is, he's 17th century, but his work, Mexico undergoes this kind of enlightenment in science and medicine in the 18th century, and more European works are being read. So this is a period in which people were reading Morisseau. And he wrote that the notion that female virginity could be determined by the state of a woman's hymen, quote, was a potent error, for if this membrane is found in some women, it is very clear that this goes against the design of nature, since it is not found in the female fetus, nor in all girls or women of any age, among whom there is no other sign by which we may conjecture their virginity. So I was interested, and I found that this kind of thing actually continues in medical literature published in Mexico up to the mid-19th century. I looked at midwives' tracts and state texts, and they say in the texts, you can't tell. You can't tell from a physical examination that necessarily a woman is a virgin or not. So that carries on, as I say, through to the 19th century. At the end of my talk, we'll see what changes at the end of the century. So then my question was, well, if physical evidence, if biological evidence did not determine virginity, what did? How are people deciding whether or not a woman is a virgin, particularly when it has all, you know, all this tension and pressure surrounding it? And it becomes clear, looking at various kinds of sources, that other criterion are used than biological evidence. And I guess I would say, if I had to describe in a word how it's determined if a woman is a virgin, it's connections is what matters. It's a discourse. And it's a family mobilizing, usually financial means, to correct the official record. I'm going to illustrate this by describing one case, and this is from an Inquisition trial from the Inquisition in Mexico in the mid-17th century, and it was a trial of a partera, a midwife, called Isabel Hernandez, and she's a mestiza, a woman of mixed indigenous and Spanish background. She's also described as a curandera, which is a healer. And she was brought before the court of the Inquisition in Mexico City under charges of witchcraft, hechicería. And in the course of her trial, various conflicts are brought up. And one of them is a charge that she provided an abortion to a woman who was considered to be a virgin. This woman's family, Hernandez testified, had publicized her condition as simply the, quote, detention of the menses. And this detention of the menses is something I also have found in medical literature, actually in Europe, but also in Mexico in the colonial period. And it's a condition that people would describe as one of the many reasons why a woman's menstruation would stop. And people knew that, yes, it was a sign of pregnancy, but there were many other reasons why a woman's period might stop. So if you were a woman whose period had stopped and your family knew about it, rather than saying, well, yeah, our daughter's pregnant, you could say, well, no, her, yeah, she's got that thing, that detention of the menses. And so just to give you an example about this, from a work published in Mexico in 1788 by a Mexican physician called Juan Manuel Venegas. He published the Compendio de la Medicina Practica that year, 1788. He described the detention of the Menses to have such morally innocent and self-contradictory origins as, quote, the good or bad disposition of the organs, health or sickness, robust and weak complexions, hot or cold climates. So lots of things could cause detention of the menses. And this was something that families could use. And I'm not saying, you know, that there aren't other reasons why women's menstruation stops other than pregnancy, but this was something that people could also, was a kind of appealing discourse. So in Hernandez's case, their daughter, whose menses had merely been detained, called this midwife, Hernandez, to her side. But then, as Hernandez testified, their daughter actually goes into labor. Hernandez had given the woman some powders, and she had given birth that same night. And nothing more is said about what happened to the fetus. Subsequently, however, Hernandez testified, and this is a quote from Hernandez from her Inquisition trial, that talk ran in Tlaxcala, where she was a town she originated in, of this confessant and how she'd cured the woman with some powders. And while many friends asked her what powders she had used, she responded that they were some powders that she knew and did not want to say, when the truth was that she had said this because she had not wanted people to know about the moral laxity of this woman because of her good reputation. Hernandez clearly helped this woman, whose family she described as gente honrada, honorable people, to dispatch with her fetus, allowing the public to believe that she had merely cured the woman of the acceptable menstrual detention. And this is an example of how people could determine virginity. They, elites, and this is this case, it's gente honrada, they're a wealthy family, they could alter the official public record, if not always the unofficial public voice, because talk did run in Tlaxcala, about the state of virginity of young female family members. And there are a couple of historians who have investigated this kind of practice further. If you're interested, the most well-known is a woman called Anne Twynham, and she has studied the whole history of illegitimacy and examined how colonial elites often use strategies, including post hoc marriages or secret pregnancies, in order to preserve a woman's reputation of virginity. And it was the reputation rather than the biology that really mattered. So that's kind of the foundation and gives you some sense of how things operated in the colonial period. The argument that I'm making is that by the late 19th century, at the close of the 19th century, there is a central shift that occurs. And the central shift is that the preservation of female virginity, once the preoccupation most fervently of elites, became a matter of greater concern for a larger sector of the population. And there are different ways that we see this sort of greater concern manifest in 19th century society. I'll describe three of them. The first is, I'm drawing from the research of a social historian of 18th and 19th century Mexico called Sonia Lipset Rivera. And she's just published a book dealing with ideas about sexual honor and space in the era of transition from colony to nation. And one of the things that's interesting about her work is that she shows how concerns about female respectability and virginity were cemented into the very design of houses and various kinds of domestic architecture in this period. Female enclosure within the home signified respectability, virginity, and chastity, whereas movement beyond it, into the street, into doorways, windows, and thresholds, could signify moral laxity and sexual licentiousness. I think it's really interesting that this concern goes into architecture, and it's not architecture of nobility, it's architecture of working class families. Another example comes from the scholarship of a historian of Oaxaca, southern Mexico, called Catherine Sloan. And she wrote a book that's about rapto cases. This is the crime that involves the forced abduction of a woman for sexual or conjugal purposes. And Catherine Sloan studied about 200 of these cases from 1850 to 1914 and found, among other startling things, that, quote, in more than 90% of the 212 cases, the girls voluntarily ran away with their suitors and even, in some cases, engineered the entire escapade. So how does that show reverence for virginity? You have these young women who are, you know, involved in these cases that involve forced abduction for sexual purposes or conjugal purposes. What she found was that the reason why young women were engineering these cases is that they were dealing with it as a strategy to, in many cases, to marry a person that their family had objected to. So usually the father would say, no, that's not the appropriate suitor for you. One way to ensure you could marry the person your father objected to would be to go off. It's sort of like a Jane Austen novel. You go off, there's a public scandal, someone's lost her virginity, okay, so we got to get married. And it's a strategy. Now, the interesting thing for me is that this is being used now by, again, her cases are working class people, and many of them are indigenous people. That kind of strategy was used in the colonial period, but we have evidence, much more evidence, of it being used amongst elites. So the interesting thing is that virginity here has become a normative value for both the women themselves and for their families, and it's that reason that they can make, that they actually have a bargaining chip to use. Okay. The final source I want to discuss, and I'm coming back to the source I discussed and mentioned at the beginning of my talk, is this work, El Himen en Mexico, the work published by Francisco Flores in 1885. And I think of his tract as the crown jewel in my argument about a shift in perceptions of Mexican virginity. I'll be happy to, if you have other questions about it, I'll be happy to discuss them when we have a bit of a question period. Apparently this was a text that was really celebrated in his day. As I said, it was chosen to represent Mexico in the World's Fair. I found it mentioned in newspapers from the time period. Someone accused him of plagiarism. One of his kind of rival professors said he had plagiarized some of his evidence, and it was actually belonged to the School of Medicine, and Flores wrote this big defense, and it was in the paper. So it had some traction and attention in 1885. It reads now as a truly bizarre document. And the author declared that his aim in producing this tract was to create a reliable work that could be used in the kinds of cases that I've described, in rape trials, in ongoing Palabra de Casamiento trials, to determine the state of female virginity and assess the possibility of rape or deflowerment. He sought to undertake the classification of the hymen to create a scientific formula by which the force of resistance characteristic of various forms of the hymen could be measured in terms of the likelihood each possessed. And now I really do sound like Todd Akin, or Flores sounds like Todd Akin, to resist penetration, whether by, quote, the penis in ravishment or rape, the finger, the mouth of a bottle, a plug, etc., in lesbian lovemaking. And I won't go through all of, he has this whole study, he measures and calculates and studies various forms of the hymen, and he's interested in seeing which one is the strongest and which one is the least strong. And he has actually a formula that he creates. This is just a page of the text, but you can see down there at the bottom, his basic formula is TM equals P times T, and then he works it out for all these other variations, but TM represents the mechanical force, P the sum of all forces, and T the time involved to, quote, overcome the resistance of the labial hymen. knowledge of this kind, he believed, could help substantiate young women's claims to virginity and groom's perhaps unjustified accusations of their bride's obvious prior sexual experience in matrimony suits and rape trials of his period. He also sought to chart the unique biological qualities of Mexican women in a framework of nationalistic claims about the physiological and specifically gynecological characteristics of Mexican women. He repeatedly asserts in El Himen en Mexico that one particular form of the hymen, which he calls the herradura, was manifest more frequently in Mexican females than in any other nation that had examined the topic. And there actually is a literature. So he's like, yeah, we've got the herradura, you guys don't. And he, a few years earlier, Flores had produced a tract attempting to chart the particularly national characteristics of women's pelvises. So he does the same thing. He has the idea that there's this particular hymen that's Mexican and also a particular pelvis that was specific to Mexico. And this was a position that was celebrated also by the most prominent obstetrician of his day, Juan Maria Rodriguez. Flores also used this work to support his era's new perspective on the importance of widespread prenuptial female virginity. In the 16th and 17th centuries, as I talked about in the early part of my talk, many Mexicans abstractly associated female virginity with the supreme religious virtue of Mary's example. But they also managed to accept the contradiction between the ideal of the reverence for virginal purity and practices that embraced a reality of women's participation in sexual acts. Elite Mexican society, whose concern with maintaining the viceroyalty's racial and class-based social hierarchies, augmented its need to police premarital female virginity. But even among this group, the possibility of social virginity, correctly deployed, might trump the taint of the loss of biological virginity. By the late 19th century, however, female virginity had become, for Francisco Flores and for his contemporaries, a crucial indicator of a nation's civilization, and a reliable mechanism was therefore necessary to account for its presence. Today, he exclaimed, quote, virginity is one of the most precious jewels for which man searches. Civilized nations all scrutinize its maintenance, establishing rigorous punishments against all acts committed against it. The stakes for virginity, it would seem, had been raised. No longer a requirement only for the preservation of racial purity of elite dynasties, the preservation of virginity before marriage had become a requirement for all Mexican women, for women of all races and classes were implicated in the work of producing and reproducing a modern, civilized, and prosperous nation.